be a heart reflection for me to give, because I'm a little bit bothered, and I'm finding myself somewhat in the position of preaching what I don't necessarily practice very well. And you'll see what I mean as I go through. But this kind of leads me to a place where I really don't have answers or promises to give anybody. And I'm kind of at a point where I just need to turn it over to God. And I'm going to need some help. There's no real obvious place to begin, so I'll start with a quick story that goes back to 1968. George Harrison returned from somewhat of a sabbatical with his bandmates from the Beatles in India, and he was frustrated as a bandmate, as a person, and as a member of the human race. He was someone who believed that the power of love could conquer all, but he was beginning to have doubts that it actually would. 1968 was a year that was filled with a lot of turbulence. There was war. There were many high-profile assassinations that year that altered the course of history. His band wasn't getting along very well, so he had little external inspiration for any songwriting, so he tried embracing randomness, decided to open a book to any page, and would commit to writing a song based on the first words that he saw. Those words were "gently weeps." He closed the book and wrote that down. Elijah today sounds frustrated too. He goes to the desert lamenting his inadequacy and begging, not really necessarily for forgiveness, but for relief from the pressure and the stress of the expectations on him. Instead, God offers him forgiveness and redemption. He is nourished both physically and spiritually with bread from God. George Harrison, thinking of the disharmony that he saw in his personal life and in his band, his professional life, and in the world around him, went on to write lyrics. "I look at you all, see the love there that's sleeping, while my guitar gently weeps." The lyrics just flowed on from there. "I look at the world and I notice it's turning, while my guitar gently weeps. With every mistake, we must surely be learning, still my guitar gently weeps." It could be interpreted as the sound of someone who has given in to depression, but I don't really interpret it that way. I think of it more as a recognition of the unrealized potential for love, and it connects modern generations to the biblical scriptural need for Jesus, the bread of life. We as people are on a constant search for a cure to what may frustrate us about the failings of fellow humans. It seldom seems to occur to us that forgiveness is the most effective way of unburdening ourselves from the harm that we do to ourselves while brooding about the state of the people that we share our country and that we share this world with. You know, it's everywhere in the scriptures that we as Christians around the world hear all the time. Paul writes to the Ephesians to remove bitterness, fury, anger, shouting, reviling, and malice. "Be kind to one another," he says. "Be compassionate, forgiving one another as God has forgiven you in Christ." That was 1900 years ago. And look around. Does it really look like that's what's happening? My guitar weeps too. But the good news is, when we're in the desert, God offers us bread. Elijah learned what forgiveness could do for him. Paul learned what forgiveness could do for him. Many Christians know well what a relationship with God can do for them. Yet I must confess, I'm still prone to anger and frustration. And there are many Christians out there fighting with other Christians about which denominational interpretation is correct, fighting with Muslims and Jews verbally, politically, and physically. The bread of life isn't just for each of us as individuals. It is for us to accept, but also to share. As Paul charges us to pay it forward, saying, "Forgive one another as God has forgiven you." I read something once, and I was hesitant to share it, but I will. I was just cruising around on the internet one day when I saw something that a pastor named Joel Tooley has shared. It came from another author. And it said, the problem is many of the people in need of saving are already in churches. And at least part of what they need saving from is the idea that God sees the world the same way that they do. At first I thought how much I agreed with that. And then came a sobering thought in my head. It says, what makes you so sure this quote isn't talking about you? So I saved it in a spot where I can see it every day as a reminder to reflect on that. Because it isn't about me figuring out how things are supposed to work and then winning everyone over to my vision. What it is about is me following God's way and being an instrument of His love. There's another quote that I found on the internet, and the quote reads that being rude is easy. It does not take any effort and is a sign of weakness and insecurity. Kindness shows great self-discipline and strong self-esteem. Being kind is not always easy when dealing with rude people. Kindness is a sign of a person who has done a lot of personal work and has come to a great self-understanding and wisdom. Choose to be kind over being right, and you'll be right every time, because kindness is a sign of strength. The Apostle Paul couldn't have said it better himself. Yet here we are in 2018, with over 1,900 years of New Testament history, still repeating many of the same mistakes. In psychology, there are a couple of social phenomenons that can at least categorize some of the self-defeating conflict that seems to dominate our human existence. And one is called the fundamental attribution error, which is really a very fancy way of saying it's kind of like that scenario where I walk into a room and see a pile of someone else's clothes or other stuff cluttering up the space and say, you did that because you're lazy. But when the same person finds something of mine laying around and calls me out, well, that's a one-off. That's because of the circumstances of my situation. I wouldn't normally do that. This was an exception. When you mess up, it's because your character is flawed, and when I mess up, it's because of the circumstances. Somewhere in the middle lies the truth, and while we all work really hard to fool each other, God's not fooled. Not one of us on this world is less in need of His forgiveness than anyone else. Another psychological theory that I think of is one that's called the just world fallacy, and that's the underlying belief that people tend to get what they deserve. It is that sense that we all have that when people do bad things, they'll ultimately pay some sort of price for it. But it gets much worse when it is used to reverse justify or back justify. We see something terrible that's happened to someone, and therefore, because it is a just world, we just assume they must have done something to deserve it. Those who have good lives deserve it. Those who have unfortunate lives, therefore, must also deserve it, even though we have little eyewitness knowledge of what may have occurred in their lives. We may think we don't need to know their details. We can tell ourselves that we've seen enough to know how people end up in those types of predicaments. This continues to happen even though we've had 1,700 years of Gospels, where Luke says, do not judge, and you will not be judged. Do not condemn, and you will not be condemned. Forgive, and you will be forgiven. Matthew says in chapter 7, do not judge, or you too will be judged. For in the same way you judge others, you will be judged. And with the measure you use, it will be measured against you. John in chapter 3, for God did not send His Son into the world to condemn the world, but to save the world through Him. John again in chapter 8, let any of you who has no sin cast the first stone at her. When I had that thought about the internet quote where I asked myself what made me so sure that the brilliant quote didn't apply to me, I could have just as easily have been reading Matthew chapter 7, why do you look at the speck of sawdust in your brother's eye and pay no attention to the plank that is in your own eye? How can you say to your brother, let me take the speck out of your eye, when all the time there is a plank in your own eye? You must first take the plank out of your own eye in order to see clearly enough to remove the speck from your brother's eye. And we see all kinds of debates today, political debates or otherwise, debates about religion, about all sorts of things. about all sorts of things, and oh, how much of it is just people with planks in their eyes talking about the specks in their opponent's eyes. People looking to earthly solutions to what concerns them before they would think to take and eat and then share the bread of life. To me, it looks like something like maybe substituting the bread of life with what could possibly be described as a Twinkie in the moment. The Twinkie tastes good and it feels good, and when you're done, you want more, all the while sacrificing the long-term harm it will do to you for the satisfaction of 2 minutes of pleasure. It is said that in the country of the blind, the one-eyed man is king. And back when I was growing up, I remember McDonald's used to keep a tally on the sign bearing the golden arches outside of each restaurant that said, that counted how many hamburgers they'd sold, how many billions of hamburgers they'd sold. I remember watching the number slowly creep up over the years, somewhere around 35 billion to 55 billion. Sometime it got to around 100 billion and it made headlines that they finally crossed the 100 billion threshold. And somewhere around that time, somebody in their corporate hierarchy must have just decided to say the heck with it, and their signs were changed to read, billions and billions served. So many, they just decided to stop keeping count. 1,700 years of gospels and counting. For almost 2,000 years, people have been dying angry, holding on to grudges that they didn't need to. We can accept the bread, but it isn't enough to have our bread and tell everyone else to find their own bread. Give your life to God by sharing the bread, even with, and perhaps most importantly, with those who don't deserve it. Doing this, you can unburden yourself, and as you learn, please don't mind if I might ask you for help finding a way too, because I'm struggling with it. There seems to be a third part of the equation. We can accept God's forgiveness and we can learn to forgive others, but another challenge is also forgiving ourselves. The journey between the heart and the head is indeed tough to navigate. One of the obstacles in that road is understanding the difference between accepting forgiveness from God and others and the difference between that and accepting and forgiving ourselves. How do I learn from my mistakes if I don't hold on to it, though? Well, if I leave it to God, who can be against me? The love that sleeps while George's guitar weeps can be awakened, and when that happens, Jesus promises us that we will have nothing to fear, and that death does not conquer, and that life will be eternal.